that Negroes are losing their grasp on this very serious aspect.
Why do you think that is?
Of their culture. Well, I think the reasons are manifold. For example, when I was a boy and my grandmother and my aunt helped me buy my first saxophone, the saxophones cost $350, $400, and now they're $2,000. So let's say that certain types of instruments, the kind of instruments that John Coltrane played on, and these people that Jimmy Heath and these people, that they're not accessible to most Negro youth today. It's much cheaper to buy a guitar or a drum or even to sing, because you don't. It's like, why don't you see blacks playing golf and tennis or skiing or playing hockey? I live in an area where we produce really great hockey players, but I've never seen a black child who's been good at it because the equipment costs too much. And so I think so-called jazz, well, just say jazz equipment is becoming too expensive for the average black youngster. Further, I think something you mentioned earlier, the media, that essentially jazz evolved in the era of radio, an entirely different, shall we say, aesthetic existed at that time. When we have television, it's a different informational process. We have a visual impact and an oral one, and black people being, as I say, more, I think, geared to an oral tradition. We don't, we're not given all the tools in school to become good readers. We're not encouraged to read. We're very addicted to television. I had this conversation with my good friend William Cosby, and I asked him why do we only see on Sesame Street, or do we only hear Quincy Jones and Diana Ross? Why don't you play a little Charlie Parker? And he expressed the idea that it would be antithetical to the needs of the overall commercial market, that black people don't want to hear this kind of music anymore. But I suggested they don't want to hear it because nobody's playing it for them anymore. I get up in the morning and my wife, who's Jewish, incidentally, my wife has on the radio Mozart and Bach and Beethoven, and those guys are 500 years old. And they tell me Charlie Parker's old-fashioned. You know, so I suggest that there's a case of special pleading and that somehow our music has been systematically kept out of the media. Where it's played, it's relegated to FM stations. It's never played on AM. I think that's a tragedy.
Well, I was wondering what you think of rap music, since you're interested both in music and in oral culture and oral poetry.
Well, rap music is like the Daily News. You know, if I really wanted to listen to a rap, I'd listen to Duke Ellington reciting "My People" at the introduction of his that beautiful album by that title, or Duke reciting "Peter and the Wolf." I think rap music is rather, shall we say, immature. It rhymes, and you keep time with the beat, you know. But
what about its resourcefulness? Since you were talking before about people who can't afford instruments, and this is music you can make yourself with a couple of records and a microphone.
Yes, but I'm a little bit, you know, away from that. I know about remedial education, okay, and I know about the need for it. I've been a social worker. I've taught school in New York, in the Bronx, Brooklyn, Manhattan, all the tough spots. And, you know, I've felt this thing very deeply, like most of us. But I think too often, and this was part of my conversation with Bill, we're stereotyped and we're put into a kind of a Fat Albert bag so that, you know, we're only perceived that way today. We forget Paul Robeson. We forget Richard Wright. I'm not espousing the intellectual over the self-made man. But on the other hand, I don't think they're mutually exclusive entities.
Saxophonist and composer Archie Shepp, who will be performing this evening at the Afro-American Museum on 7th and Arch Streets. Also on the program will be a performance by poet and playwright Amiri Baraka. The performance this evening is a tribute to Charlie Parker. For more information, you can call the Afro-American Museum at 574-0380. That's 574-0380. There are sets at 8 and 10 o'clock, and the museum is located at 7th and Arch Streets. It's 22 minutes after 3. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Today's show is a show devoted to music. At about 4:15, we'll be hearing from Hank Osnetsky, who's the founder and leader of the Klezmer Conservatory Band, which is based in Boston. They play a mix of traditional Yiddish music and jazz. With me now on Fresh Air are the members of the new wave folk group, the Washington Squares. In the early 80s, the three members of this group performed with new wave bands, Tom Goodkind with the U.S. Ape, Bruce Pascoe with the Invaders, and Lauren Agnelli with Nervous Rex. Lauren also wrote rock criticism under the pen name Trixie A. Baum. In early 1983, they got tired of the new wave scene and formed the Washington Squares. The repertoire includes traditional folk music as well as pop folk music from the late 50s and early 60s, songs recorded by groups like Peter, Paul, and Mary, the Kingston Trio, and the Seekers. They include people like Paul Robeson and the group The Weavers as their influences. They also perform original material, as well as doing acoustic folk-style parodies of current rock, pop, and new wave songs. They'll perform one of these medleys for us in a few minutes. Also with the members of the Washington Squares today is Jeff Berman, who we'll be hearing on bongos. The Washington Squares perform folk music with genuine affection, but their stage presence also includes a lot of irony. On stage, they look like pop versions of beatniks, complete with sunglasses and berets with goatees for the men. They just issued me a beatnik kit, which includes wool beret, sunglasses, pearls, and a map of Greenwich Village. They've mostly performed at New York New Wave clubs, where they've become very popular. They're currently in town to perform this weekend at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. They'll be featured at tomorrow afternoon's 4 o'clock concert. And for more information on the Philadelphia Folk Festival, which takes place this weekend, you can call 287-7818. That's 287-7818. And if you have MTV, you can also see the Washington Squares 11 o'clock this Sunday night in a feature story. Well, before they perform live for us and before we all talk, let's listen to a recording of one of their original songs. This is called New Generation.
The
Washington Squares, and they'll be performing live for us in just a couple of minutes on Fresh Air, and they're in Philadelphia to perform this weekend at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. I want to welcome you all to the show. And you all played in new wave bands before performing folk music. Why did you leave the new wave scene? What was dissatisfying about it? Lauren, do you want to start?
Well, I think the problem was that there weren't any good pop bands around that I wanted to join anymore, especially ones with girls in it.
What, did you find the new wave bands more sexist than other bands?
No, it's just difficult because, you know, there were a couple of bands that were good, and some of them would allow you to have girls, and some of them wouldn't. I'm not saying they're being sexist. I'm saying that's what they wanted for their look, for their sound, whatever. And when my band broke up, I just decided, I can't do this again. I can't do it this way. You know, it was just too disheartening. And so I just laid off it for a while.
Tom, what was your reason for leaving New Wave?
Well,
You run a club, too, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a real good gig at the Peppermint Lounge, a club that I started in 1980. And was continuing to work there through 1984. And I had a great gig. I was hiring all the bands there. I brought in bands like Flock of Seagulls and Men at Work and the Go-Go's and Duran Duran and all these new music bands, as well as giving the Cramps their permanent gig in New York. What happened is the scene seemed to be lacking a certain emphasis. Our generation didn't seem to have much in the form of leadership or morality. When I look back at my older sister's generation, which she used to drag me into when I was a little kid, going down to Greenwich Village and with all the berets and goatees and snapping of fingers and this and that, underneath all that fun was a distinct political and moral movement to break down the walls of society. It seems like the new music scene took all of that for granted as things swung slowly right. And I thought that there was a desperate need to get back to a sort of music where people could actually listen to the lyrics. And actually get involved in the writing or passing down of music that could change things.
Bruce, what was your reason?
Well, I always thought one of the nicest things and one of the worst things about rock and roll was that it's a very limited kind of palette. You know, it's a very harmonically limited thing, which when it's great, you know, it takes a lot of skill to make something great out of three chords. On the other hand, after doing it for 5 or 6 years in a row, it can get kind of boring and stifling. And I really felt I felt bored with rock and roll guitar. I felt bored with the fact that the audience reaction was more of like, if I play loud enough, I'll hurt them and then they'll move their bodies. So I really wanted to switch over to acoustic music. Tom and I were playing in a band called Animal Luxury at the time, having just released a new version of the Peppermint Twist. And it was around that time that I really felt really bored and stagnant with the music. I wanted to switch to acoustic. I was embarrassed to tell Tom about it. I thought he would just like think I was out of my mind. At that point, we just happened to go see Wasn't That a Time with the story of the Weavers and their subsequent last reunion, and we all went to see it and we cried and we said, hey, there's really something that happened there. We liked the whole idea that there could be music that could say something, and besides the fact it was very, very harmonically pretty. So that basically convinced me that something could be done, and besides the fact I always liked to be kind of different, and I thought it was one way to be original in the popular music scene, which is rather difficult these days. Of course, everything's been done, you know, and revived 10 times.
Well, why don't we hear an example of the kind of music that you're playing now? Tom, you want to introduce it for us?
Sure. This one's a union song. We dig playing union songs because we were just involved in a couple of union movements in New York, which became very successful, like the Voice Writers Strike, which we played for. We had them all singing this one. This is called Which Side Are You On? As some of you already know out there, it's by Florence Reese, and it's about the Harlan County Union Movement. Come on, all you workers, good news to you, I'll tell about how this union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 Which side are you on?
sounds great. My guests are the members of the group, the Washington Squares, and they include Bruce Pascoe, and Tom Goodkind, or is it Goodkind?
Goodkind.
Okay.
It's Agnelli, actually.
Lauren Agnelli.
No, that's not my name. My name's Goodkind.
And Jeff Berman. There were things that you weren't happy about with new wave music, like that there are very few women in it and that it wasn't political and everything. But why go?
It's just there were a lot of them, but I mean, just a lot of them I don't like. I mean, there are just a few.
Okay.
Can I say something about that?
Yeah, yeah.
I really feel that new wave is the least sexist music of any other form of music. I think they did a lot to involve women guitar playing. I mean, you see Lauren playing a guitar because that's acceptable to the new wave movement. Ronnie Gilbert did not. And Mary did not. Lauren is.
Would you second that, Lauren?
Joan Jett does. Chrissy Hynde does.
And they're new wave.
Emmy Lou. No, she's not new wave.
But why did you choose folk music, though? You could have, decided to stay with rock and to do a more politically committed kind of rock instead of moving to traditional music and songs that Peter, Paul, and Mary recorded.
I think it's a question of the old messages, the medium effect. And the fact is people, and ourselves included, associate folk music with a sort of activist kind of spirit. And the problem with what happened with folk music is it turned into wimp music in the 70s, and it became just soft, nice, easy listening music, and all the spirit went out of it. And if you watch tapes of the Weavers or Peter, Paul, Mary, they're really getting into it, and they're really moving, and there's that went out of it. James Taylor does not swing heavy. And so we felt that we could bring back that feeling and that people would know where we were coming from just because we were playing folk music. We'd be in a position to express ourselves politically and socially a lot easier than if we were just a rock and roll band.
The outfits are really just our way of having fun and telling people that we do come from Greenwich Village. We got real tired of dressing British and pretending that we were from England, which is what most new wave bands I know do. And we wanted people, no matter where we came from, to recognize this coming from our hometown of Greenwich Village, where all great movements start from.
Basically, folk music is much prettier and it's easier to sing, in a nice way. And I mean, as growing up, I used to really love to listen to like Judy Collins records and Melanie records and things,
Let's talk about the way you dress on stage, that kind of visual irony that you appear with. You want to compare what you'd wear and how you'd look when you were in new wave bands to how you look now with the Washington Squares? You want to start, Tom?
Yeah, I just gotten back from a trip to London, and I've been wearing Johnson suits, which are very 50s style, in a way. I'd be wearing suits from Trash and Vaudeville and other secondhand shops along St. Mark's Place. Usually tuxedos, what have you, that kind of clothing. Sort of, I'm really poor, but I'm dressing rich kind of thing. Slick back hair with grease, no facial hair at all. Isn't that? And these days, I found us looking more like a chess shop chic, the back to goatees and this and that, things that classify intellectual thinking. It's like the other day there was a concert in New Jersey we played at where someone did a tribute to Elvis, and I wasn't really into that because he was sort of a racist. He always voted for George Wallace, and I said we'd rather do a tribute to Groucho
because we're Marxists.
Lauren, how did you appear for new wave bands compared to how you dress now for performances?
Well, my hair has always been about the same style, but I used to dye it black all the time. And now it's sort of a weird reddish, blondish, brownish, which is, I guess, the way it's growing out. And what else? I used to wear the same kind of stuff, except more colorful. I mean, I'm wearing a lot of black these days and blue and... I've always dressed kind of, I think, conservatively, but like from thrift stores, When I was a new wave band, I tried to be more outlandish. I still have a purple silk suit that I really like that I used to wear a lot. But in this band, you know, it's more like you wear your turtlenecks, you wear your simple white sneakers or your black shoes, and it's so easy to pack. I can't tell you. I can pack in 10 minutes to go anywhere the way I'm dressing now.
Turtlenecks are kind of de rigueur for the beatnik look, aren't they?
Yeah, and T-shirts, sweatshirts, anything that's just classic and simple and low-key. It's nice. And just wear your hair straight if you're a girl.
Black and
lots
white.
Of eye makeup. I like that.
Apocalyptic colors, black and white.
Bruce, anything you want to add about image?
Just, no, it was a little more flamboyant, I think. I've always actually really dug the beatnik image. And as a child, I can remember going into the Dell's drugstore down the block and picking up a beatnik kit and with money I took from my mom's pocketbook and running home and hiding in the bathroom and putting it on and feeling really great about it.
Well, you have a nicely developed goatee that you're sporting now.
It's taken me a year to do this. Certain parts of it came in really slowly. Like this side, for like a year, it was barren. And I had a wish for it to come out, and it finally did. And boy, shaving sometimes, I have to be real careful. It's not like you can't just zip, zip, zip anymore. You have to, like, shave your cheeks, and then you get down to the maintenance of the face hair.
I got to say, for the most part, we dig playing to new wave audiences more than folk audiences these days. I find folk audiences coming to see us and saying, "Oh, Madge, remember them." And mistaking us for some other group that they have in their faint, in their memories. I really dig breaking it open to a new audience, which is really where our band's geared towards, is at new music clubs.
Well, what's the difference between the way you handle the material and, say, the way the Weavers did? How would you distinguish?
We're off the main reason, the main thing is we're off the street in 1980. They were off the street in 1940.
I think
and
we're much more raw.
You have to take all the influences that occurred in between and put them into account.
Okay. You want to perform another song?
Yes.
Yes.
actually, we're going to vote. This next song was given to us by a gentleman who's a political scientist who goes to Eastern European countries and hangs out there. And we met him, and we asked him if he could find us some sort of political song, underground song from an Eastern Bloc country that no one would know here. And he gave us a song called "Mury," which means walls or brick walls, actually in Polish. And it's a song that was sung in prison by people who were arrested for being members of Solidarity. It's sort of their anthem, and also. I think he said that it appeared on the beginning of a tape, which he called Radio Solidarity, which was sort of, I mean, they would tape these 3-hour-long union meetings, and then they would risk their lives smuggling them around. And I guess they'd sit there, that's what they listened to in their Walkman in Poland. But anyway, it was the beginning, this song would be on the beginning of the tape. It would say, like, this is Radio Solidarity, and this song would be something like this.
It's hip.
It's cool. 1, 2.
We must. But the singer was strong, and he raised up his song, even though he sang out alone. The even marching of the crowd, the young and honest men brought down. The walls are rising, rising, rising. Chains are swaying on the ground. The even marching of the crowd, the young and honest men brought down. The walls are rising, rising, rising. Chains are swaying on the ground.
That sounds great. That's the Washington Squares. And they're in town to perform at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. Their concert will be tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock. The members are Bruce Pascoe, Tom Goodkind, Lauren Agnelli, with Jeff Berman on tambourine and bongos.
Fabulous.
Jeff Berman
is like happening today.
He's the best.
Well,
he's hot.
Our listeners can't see you, and for listeners just tuning in, I'll remind you that I was just issued by them a couple of minutes ago a beatnik kit, which comes with a beret, a string of pearls, and sunglasses. And on the one hand, you have the seriousness of the music that they're playing, but the irony that their visual image offers. Now, you're all, I think, too young to have actually grown up during the beatnik era, so to speak. Obviously, it really intrigues you. What are your connections to beatnik style?
Well, I worked lots of weird jobs in restaurants, and I used to meet all these old beats. And I worked in a place where I had all these painters coming in and telling stories. And
this is in New York?
Yeah. And wherever I go, I just, you know, I meet the best loonies. And anyway, my connection was just talking to people word of mouth and then getting interested in reading books, like The Beat Generation by Bruce Cook and Desolate Angel. I thought it was a really good biography on Jack Kerouac, and just Kerouac books and stuff from the period. And, you know, you just read about it and you get to meet the people and you realize, oh, they're just people too, and it's lots of fun. But it had some meaning behind it. It was like really good bohemian movement for a while.
I don't know that Kerouac ever wore sunglasses, a goatee, and a beret.
Actually, they really hated the entire Life magazine, Maynard G. Krebs, Dobie Gillis version of the Beatniks, except... these days, it's accepted, by the public. It's accepted by the public as indicative of a bohemian lifestyle. We really hearken to the bohemian lifestyle as opposed to beatniks, which is just a media term. And as for myself, I was always anything that seemed to signal some sort of alternative culture was always fascinating to me. And reading books poems by Allen Ginsberg, like Howl, which is, a definitive kind of counterculture document, or Naked Lunch by William Burroughs, for instance, or Desolation Angels, or On the Road by Jack Kerouac. It, of course, influenced a whole generation before me, but it also showed me that it was okay to be... to be my own free thinker. And that's basically where we're coming from, is the whole freedom movement that, you do what you want to do, and, everyone's different and should have the right to be able to be different.
Although, I feel, although both the beatnik movements and bohemian movements are things we like to emulate, the bohemian movement, of course, being from the 1910s with John Reed and Mabel Dodge and doing their parlor conferences, which was very political and very hip, as well as Pete Seeger coming out of the Village later in the 30s with Woody Guthrie, meeting him there at the Almanac House where the Almanac Singers formed. And then of course, the Bohemian, the Beatnik movement later, which was dubbed by, I guess, Time Life magazine.
Tell them about Edgar, too.
Here you go. In the 1850s, you had in the Village, which is our home for many, many years, not as long as those guys were around. You have Edgar Allan Poe meeting people like Walt Whitman and Pfaff's Bar and Grill on Broadway and Bleecker.
It's a condominium now.
The main thing that I'd like to emphasize about us coming from the village and us wearing this beatnik apparel, or I don't know how you pronounce
chaparral.
The word chaparral, it is a put on. That's what I want to say about me wearing this thing. It is a put on because it's the only way that we can be represented as representing the alternate culture coming from Greenwich Village and in a traditional way. Just as Reagan is bringing back all of these traditions of church, state, and marriage and all these things, we are bringing back the great tradition of counterculture. Just as John Kenneth Galbraith cited Greenwich Village as an ideal center on the outskirts of a city for a sort of an anti-culture to form, we represent the alternative for the college student who can't see his way to become a stockbroker or fit himself into that
scene. There aren't many signposts in today's popular culture for young people like there was when we were growing up. There was always, you know, you wanted to know what was cool. You bought a Beatles record or you listened to their interview and you'd say, oh, wow, what are these guys doing? Look what they're wearing. Can I be like that? And then, you know, you'd have Bob Dylan singing, and you who philosophize, and you could say, oh, listen to this intelligence. What's he talking about? I want to go find out about that. And now you have Duran Duran talking basic, you know, basic pap formula gibberish, and the kids aren't getting, you know, even if they want an alternative, they don't know where to look for it. They don't even have any signposts to point them in the right direction.
Yeah, Patti Smith moved out of the village. I mean, what do you have that's new wave anymore that's happening? We represent the new scene from the village. That's all.
So some new wave, you think, got really commercialized, too?
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well,
Patti retired.
I was going to say the reason why we're not going to back the punk movement is because it's very nihilistic and it's negative. And I don't think that that's a very good kind of attitude to have if you want to be something, if you want to have some fun, you know. I mean, we're into really enjoying life.
Positive and productive.
We're hedonists instead.
We're going
of
in a bunch of different directions here. The main thing I just want to say is that we represent all of those countercultural movements, from the punk movement to the beat movement to the bohemian movement, anything that you can think of.
Come on, you're contradicting me
represent,
if you say that. I don't like to endorse any negative kind of movement. I will say that much.
Well, I don't feel that punk was a negative movement. I think
At first it wasn't, but it became that.
My feeling is there was high unemployment in England, and the kids had a strike out against it. And they did it the best way they knew.
By shaving their heads.
Now, 10 years later.
Crazy color.
Now, 10 years later, it doesn't make as much sense. And Lauren's right. It's time to abandon it.
Exactly. It did have sense in the beginning, but now.
There you go, Lauren.
But let's go back to the image, though. I mean, the image that you're doing is a real, you know, pop image. It's very,
you know,
like Me Energy Krebs. Where do you know that from? Do you know it from TV?
Dobby. Dobby is still broadcast on the Christian cable network. I think it's a way for them to suck people like us in. Because, you know, you watch Dobby, and then 10 minutes later, the 400 club is on. And
700.
900.
Whatever. That club with the numbers. And the next thing you know, you're sending in your gallbladder for Jesus. So,
I wonder why I felt sick.
Exactly. No, I watched Dobby Ghost when I was a kid, and I always thought that Maynard G. Krebs, even if he is the standard pop version of Beatnik, there was something about him, there was something about his unconventionality that I just responded to, and I think a whole generation did. You know, people don't credit Maynard G. Krebs with being as significant as the Beatles with turning America on, but I think he's the Fonzie of his day, except a lot cooler. And one thing, you know, we want to be successful in this. We want people to notice us. We have something important to say. And, like, you put a hook in your music, we put a hook in the image, too. We're dressed, it's for fun. It has many levels. It's for fun. It also expresses where we come from. It expresses a tradition, a philosophical tradition. But mostly, it's fun to dress like a beatnik, for God's sake.
I guess it's a Greenwich Village, this intellectuals health food store ideal. It's sort of like it's all healthy, everything we're doing to us.
Are people like old folkies I didn't mean that. People who used to play folk music or who still do, insulted by what they're doing?
Veterans, no.
Are they insulted or are they flattered by
it? Into it.
Man, the banjo that I was playing a couple of minutes ago is Dave Guard's banjo, the same one he played on MTA.
Founder of the Kingston Trio.
Yeah, and he played with us. We played on stage with Peter Yarrow.
Do you like the Kingston Trio?
Oh boy, that's a tough.
It's a tough question.
They have good stuff.
We admire their material. We admire their success, but they're a little too white bread for us. And it's funny because David Amram, a very prestigious musician, we met him at Winnipeg, and he thought it was absolutely hysterical that because at the time the Kingston Trios represented the Wonder Bread version of America, while the Beatniks were people you wouldn't invite into your house, you know, if they had a flat tire.
Then again, without the Kingston Trio, there possibly would have never been a Peter, Paul and Mary or a Bob Dylan.
Yeah,
they opened a lot of doors to folk music. In fact, they went along with the Pete Seeger. A boycott of Hootenanny. They never played on Hootenanny because Seeger was boycotted. So they had their hip moments.
Well, basically, I find any of the people that we meet that are, say, old enough to be our parents and have been kicking around to do a lot of, they've been doing a lot of this music for a long time, I think a lot of them like us. I mean,
some of them actually.
Ronnie Gilbert, sang with
Joan
us.
Baez, she likes us.
The thing is, some of them, you know, actually. I know that they feel that we could possibly boost their careers by bringing this back. It certainly couldn't hurt.
Peter,
and it's funny,
sang with us.
But the one person we are very good friends with, John Stewart, who replaced Dave Gard in the Kingston Trio. We were just out to visit him in California, and he's the one person who, while he totally adores us and has offered to work with us, has said that he won't perform with us because he doesn't want to be seen as an old fogey trying to get on our bandwagon. Oh, excuse me.
sorry.
We're playing
big mistake.
Aren't we playing folk music?
Well, the main
another thing to recall, if your listeners remember this, is that in 1950 when the Weavers hit, they were sort of novelty, and I don't know if the folk audience really liked them very much. They had Broadway sort of orchestration behind them, and they opened a lot of doors to folk musicians, and without them, I don't know if a lot of the newer folkies would be here. Then you had the Kingston Trio in 1958 doing Tom Dooley, and they said, oh, they're for kids. We don't really like them, but they turned a lot of people onto playing guitar. And without them, I don't know, again, if Dylan would be happening or the rest.
And it's funny, we met Lindsey Buckingham while we were out west, too, and Lindsey Buckingham cites the Kingston Trio as a number one influence. He learned to play guitar from John Stewart's records.
But the funniest thing about Lindsey, his hair, and he was wearing this leather jacket, like in the middle of the summer. It's just ridiculous. They're really nice people.
So we said, Lindsey, your hair.
Lindsey, what happened? Don King, I mean, what's going on here? And I said, what do you put in it? And he just said it stands up on its own.
Is
I guess
time
he's
for
had
MTV
many
News?
Shocks in his life.
It's time for MTV News.
It's time for MTV News. This is a public service kind of thing where we turn folkies onto what's currently happening in popdom. We're gonna try Footloose
in popdom.
Popdom.
Yes. You know MTV. Put the empty in V. Okay.
I actually watch MTV a lot. I like it.
This is I watch Friday Night Videos because I don't have cable yet.
This is Loose Shoes.
This is Loose Shoes. Our sort of tribute to Footloose. One, two. One, two, three, four.
Blue shoes, Earl Butts is singing the blues. James Watt, so what? The Beach Boys are working your nut. Jesse, oh please, whoa. Why did you say high knees? Blue shoes, small feet, foot in the mouth disease.
Take it.
Hey, okay.
This is our Sydney Lauper love song.
Yeah.
Elvis's favorite new success story. It's a solemn little ditty from Purple Rain. Maybe I'm just too demanding.
I want.
Maybe I'm just like my father.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just like my mother. She's never satisfied.
Daddy.
Maybe I should see a psychiatrist.
Shrinksville.
Why do I hit the roof when doves cry?
Jelly?
What is this?
People say I don't sing in tune. Well, it makes me money. And I don't know why. No, I don't know why. Come on, feel the noise. Girls, fuck your boys. We'll get wild, wild, wild. Wild.
Boys.
That's what we said.
Here, Bruce.
I got one, dude.
Oh, we're okay. Passing the capo here. It's this a folky is, thing to do.
This is by that favorite son of Belmore, Long Island, Jelly Bowl.
Will the owner of the green Mercedes with a Woodstock bumper sticker please report to your car immediately? Your lights are on.
Ships and sighting whales. The problem this time, I just can't find the next line. Please help me looking for the longest rhyme. Whoa, for the longest rhyme. Whoa, for the longest. Why is my telephone bill so high? Should I switch to Sprint or MCI?
We can't leave without doing this song.
Oh, here, this is the song that...
As you wake up each morning to Philadelphia brand cream cheese.
That's for the festival.
Yeah, that's for all you cream cheese fans.
I came down here for a cheese fest.
Susie cream cheese especially.
That was great. That was really great. And my guests are the Washington Squares, who are in town to perform at the Philadelphia Folk Festival. Do you have a record coming out soon?
No.
Be nice.
No, but all of you record executives out there listening, or you can reach us...
In New York.
We've had a number of preliminary meetings with record companies in the last few weeks. We're represented by a real hotshot lawyer right
His
now.
His name is...
Well, I don't really
Should
want
to. Should we give it out?
No, I don't think
forget
he wants it.
But the, say who our booking agent is.
Yeah,
we're just
no, not him, Lauren. I know we're from the street, but we could get in real trouble.
Don't mention Max.
Sorry. Oh no.
Anyway, a major booking agency, ATI, that normally never signs an unsigned band, unsigned recording wise, just signed us for a long-term booking contract. They also handle the Stray Cats and Nick Lowe, AC/DC, Joni Mitchell, Richard Nixon, big people. but we're with ATI now.
Saran.
We're touring around the country, playing every week, and we're pretty much self-supporting right now, and we're real happy to say that we can pleasantly wait for the big time recording contract to come through now. We're feeling pretty comfortable.
Tell me, during the period when you were playing a new wave band, did you find yourselves covering up the early folk records that you listened to? The fact that you used to listen to Judy Collins, Lauren, and I don't know what you both listened to?
It took a long time for me to be able to play stuff like that around the house for anybody else and to admit to it. It really took a long, painful growing up process. I mean, I'm not going to say how old I was when I finally admitted to it, but I was pretty old, you know. It takes a while.
And I've got to say, honestly, I've been listening to folk my whole life, but in 1980... I tried an experiment at the Peppermint Lounge, my club, by spinning the Weavers and Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bob Gibson, whatever, at the Peppermint Lounge to see how people reacted, and they loved it. And it was just a wonderfully warm reaction from usually a crazy staff of people.
So we actually feel that people want to hear this stuff again. They want to hear music that makes them feel like they felt when they went, you know, it's a terrible world and there's garbage in the streets, but to hear something that sparks a bit of idealism and a bit of a positive feeling is great. And I can't tell you how many people come up to us and say, you know, I cried during your set, and I hope it wasn't because we were singing out of tune. But I think that they just, you know, to emotionally affect nobody ever, you know, in rock and roll, it's usually people, you know, they came back after, you know, after you threw a bottle back and hit them in the forehead, they went, you guys were great. So now it's nice. We're actually attracting a very intelligent and sensitive crowd, and young and good looking and prosperous.
We're looking forward in the future to a number of prosperous. Yeah, the yuppies of the world unite behind the Washington
Square.
We
aren't yuppies. We're yummies, young urban musicians.
Well, a couple of quick questions because we're basically running out of time. But do any of your friends who are still in new wave bands feel betrayed by your leaving new wave and going to folk and also
trying to stick electric guitars in our hands all the time, just like really? The opposite of Dylan
when Pete Seeger pulled the plug out at Newport.
Hey, you all sold out, right?
Yeah, we sold out on rock. They don't dig it.
That's right.
They wonder. They think, hey, maybe something's not screwed up.
But, you know, I keep reading.
But they love it. They come back and they watch.
I read Bob Dylan's interview.
And they're sexy.
In Rolling Stone.
They're real sexy.
I was reading Bob Dylan's interview in Rolling Stone, which, of course, proved, as usual, that the rock stars get the best acid. But he said, you know, there's no one doing new folk music anymore, and I just can't wait till he reads this issue of Rolling Stone, which we happen to be featured in. It's the one with Prince's armpit on the cover.
Scratch and sniff.
That was my joke.
Tom, do you think you're starting or helping to start a new folk revival?
All I know is that we're helping to start the Washington Squares, and I think there's a need for our band. We're not looking to start a folk revival. We're just looking to get traditional American music and maybe a new blowing in the wind back on the record charts through our band.
Well, it's really been fun to hear you perform. I really want to thank you enormously for performing
our
with
pleasure.
Us and for visiting the show. It's really great. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
My guests have been the members of the group The Washington Squares, and they include Bruce Pasco, Tom Goodkind, Lauren Agnelli, with Jeff Berman on bongos and tambourine. And thanks again for performing for us. It's really been fun. They're going to perform also at the Philadelphia Folk Festival on tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Which way is the entrance, Mark?
And for more information about the Folk Festival, you can call 287-7818. That's 287-7818. And it's
my mother.
It's at the Old Pool Farm, and it continues today through Sunday. And we have another tape of theirs we're going to listen to. This isn't as yet featured on a record, but this is a tape that they've made of the song If I Had My Way.
Delilah was a woman, fine and fair, very pleasant looking with old black hair. You read about Samson, you read about his birth, the strongest man who lived on earth. Delilah, she tempted old Samson with her mind. When he looked at her, she looked so fine. If I had my way, if I...